Today's Taisho will be on case one in the Book of Serenity. Case one is entitled, The World Honored One Ascends the Seat. Introduction. Closing the door and sleeping is the way to receive those of highest potential. Looking, reflecting, and stretching is a roundabout way for the middling and the lesser. How can it bear sitting on the carved wood seat sporting devil's eyes? If there is any bystander who doesn't agree, come forward. You can't blame him either. One day, the world honored one ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. The world honored one then got down from his seat. Verse, the unique breeze of reality, do you see it? Continuously, creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring, but nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. So I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job this morning. Everybody was sitting so still. It is, of course, day three of Sesshin, and that's challenging, right? I mean, you know, legs get tired, and we have a very intensive schedule. So it was really impressive to see everybody sitting so still. And of course, you know, we're all working on our koans as well. And koans are a wonderful, wonderful way to practice Zen. This koan in particular is interesting because I mentioned yesterday that the Mumon Kan and the Pi Yen Lu, the Wu Men Kuan and the Pi Yen Lu, the gate of no barrier or the checkpoint of no barrier, the gateless gate, and the blue rock collection or the blue cliff record. Those are both teaching, they're like textbooks, Zen textbooks, right? And this is a Zen textbook too, the Book of Serenity. And both the Pi Yen Lu, both the blue rock collection and the gateless gate, start out with Mu. One starts out with, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu said, Wu, Mu. The other one starts out with Bodhidharma saying, no holiness, great emptiness. So, you know, this is an interesting book of koans, the Book of Serenity, because the experience of Mu is number two, not number one, as it is in the other two books. And so instead of starting with Mu, the book starts with this story, little story. One day the Buddha ascended the seat. This must be like his throne where he would deliver teaching. He ascended the seat and Manjushri struck the gavel, you know, hit something made of wood with a hammer, a wooden hammer. And he said, clearly observe the Dharma, the teaching of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. So, you know, we're waiting for, I guess we're waiting for the Buddha to speak, but he doesn't speak. Instead, he got down from the seat. And that's really a wonderful koan. Right? What's this all about? Why is it first? Why is it first in the collection? So, you know, one way to understand this koan is that we all like to have the Buddha up on the on his throne. We all like to have the Buddha up on his throne. You know, there's something really comforting about seeing the Buddha on his throne in his wisdom. It says to us, maybe it says to us, there is such a thing as enlightenment, and the Buddha has it, right? The Buddha has enlightenment. It really exists. It exists, you know, and that's wonderful to know that such a thing as enlightenment exists. And, you know, I don't have a Buddha statue in here, but usually when we do sesshin at Murray Grove, there's a Buddha statue in the dining hall. And there's a Manjushri statue on the main altar in the Zen hall. But, you know, all over the Buddhist world, there's statues of the Buddha, and people love to go to see them. You know, there are some very famous Buddhas. There's an emerald Buddha in Thailand. It's a green made of emerald. There's a famous Burmese Buddha that's covered with gold. You know, he's so much gold that you can barely make out his form. There's the great Buddha of Kamakura in Japan, right? The Daibutsu, the big Buddha, one of the biggest Buddha statue in the world. All these Buddha statues, right? And all over, millions and millions of people go to temples and they light incense, right? And if you've ever seen a picture of a Chinese temple, or if you've ever been to a Chinese temple, they have a gigantic incense burner. I have a little incense burner here, right? Burning incense, but they have giant ones, and people take these big sticks of incense and light them, and the sky is smoky with incense. And people bow and pray, or they clap their hands, you know, ritually, and then they go home, you know. And all is well with the world, see. So part of the idea of this Buddha taking his seat is that this is something that's incredibly reassuring. And also, if I may say so, it asks very little of us. You know what I mean? It's like, basically, we go and admire the Buddha, right? We go and admire the Buddha. And that's a wonderful thing in a way, you know, better to admire the Buddha than not to admire the Buddha. But it limits everything, if I'm making any sense, right? I mean, the Buddha's on his throne and we're somewhere else, and we can see the Buddha and appreciate his enlightenment. But in a way, that's kind of a trap, don't you think? Because what about our enlightenment, right? What about our enlightenment? You know, how much good does the Buddha's enlightenment do if it's up there on the throne, see, and it's not here in us, if it's not here in us? And it's so comforting to know that somebody somewhere is pursuing enlightenment, right? Or has enlightenment. But in a way, that's a kind of a trap, right? Because it lets me off the hook. It lets me off the hook. I don't have to pursue enlightenment because after all, the Buddha already found it. You know, years ago, I was associated with a Sri Lankan group. We had a member in our group long ago, maybe only Jaru remembers her. But her name was Sharmini Mukherjee. And Sharmini Mukherjee was this remarkable woman who came from Sri Lanka and married an Indian gentleman who was also a member of our group for many years, Pradeep Mukherjee. And basically, Sharmini became, first Sharmini and then later Pradeep, became avid members of our group. And Sharmini was practicing quite regularly, but then she developed something called scleroderma. I don't know if it's a horrible horrible disease where your tissue, it's an autoimmune disorder, and your tissue starts dying. And she got scleroderma, particularly in her lungs. So eventually she died. But after the longest time, it took, you know, she had such a very strong spirit. And I would go once a week and sit with her before the Wednesday evening sit. I would sit at her house. And she was lucky because she found a TCM, a traditional Chinese medical person who was in New York. And it was a, you know, genius, and kept her alive many years after the doctors predicted she would be dead. But anyway, you know, she was this remarkable person, and she had a PhD in microbiology. She came here and worked, went to school and got a PhD in microbiology. And so she had not ever been in a situation where lay people could practice. In Sri Lanka, you know, monks and nuns, and there aren't very many nuns, they're mostly monks, you know, monks practice, and they are sort of in charge of practice, and ordinary people go and admire the monks and, you know, give them gifts and take care of them. But it's like, your job is to find enlightenment, and my job is to make a living. And those two things are very separate, right? And when Sharmini came here to the United States, she was shocked to see that there were like lay people doing meditation practice and actually trying to have an enlightenment experience. This was like not familiar to her. And after she passed away, I continued to have contacts with the Sri Lankan community. But my last contact was I was invited to give a talk, and I said, "This, let me teach you how to meditate." And I showed them how to meditate, and I said, you know, here's how we meditate. And somebody said, "Why are we doing this?" It's like, "What? You're Buddhist. What do you mean? Why are we doing this?" It was like, "Well, you know, we're not monks, you know, we don't have to meditate, right?" So it sort of blew my mind, right? You mean, you know, they just wanted to, you know, basically take the Buddhist teachings and apply them to their life, right? And they didn't want to go through the arduous practice of pursuing enlightenment for themselves. But actually, this is definitely not what the Buddha had in mind. You know, if you read the early Buddhist sutras, something like 20 lay people in the Buddha's lifetime, in his immediate community, achieved a great awakening. So I think the Buddha did intend for there to be monks and nuns. He definitely specifically said that. And I think he meant for those people to be like the core of the community, people who really, really practiced. But he also had this idea that ordinary people, lay people, would be practicing too and seeking enlightenment. So there's something corrupting, you know, corrupting actually, about going to the temple and seeing the Buddha and admiring the monks and saying, "Good work, keep pursuing enlightenment," right? But I myself am not going to pursue enlightenment. It's very comforting to know you are, you know, but I myself am not. You can't fault people if that's how they are, right? You can't fault people. People have their own karma. More about this later, right? People have their own karma that they have to work out. You can't make things happen, right? You can't make things happen, you know. I've known countless people who would benefit from meditation, and I'll say to them, "Boy, you know, you could really benefit from meditation." And they won't do it. It's like you can't tithe, you can't make them meditate, right? And it would help them so much, but they don't do it. But there's something, I think, a little corrupting about just admiring Buddhist statues. Or people fly to Tibet, or they fly to Bhutan, and they spend 2 weeks in Bhutan admiring the enlightened culture. But, you know, What about us? What about our enlightenment, you know? So I think that the koan starts out by saying, in a way, don't be happy with the Buddha up on the altar. right? Don't be happy with the Buddha up on the altar. You know, you have to pursue enlightenment yourself, whether you're a monk or a nun or a lay person. And you don't have to doesn't mean you must, you know. What it means, I think, is don't you want to be awake? You know, don't you want to be awake? Don't you want to know? You know, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? You know, what? You know, when I first read a book on Zen, it just blew my mind. I thought, this is what I must do. You know, this is what I must do. And I'm so glad I listened to that voice. You know, I was lucky that it spoke to me and that I was able, had the opportunity to practice with Genki Roshi and other teachers. So part of this koan is about how people should be doing what we're doing at this sesshin, right? Which is practicing the way, not just admiring the way. And everybody here has come to sesshin. Sesshin, even if you haven't been able to attend the whole thing, you're here. And that's so important. Because sesshin is the essence, the core of Zen practice, right? If somebody doesn't do sesshin and they say, I practice Zen, they're actually not telling the truth, right? You know, sesshin is the heart of Zen practice. Right? So because sesshin is where you're really taking seriously your desire to wake up. And it's totally admirable that everybody here, in my opinion, has gone to all the trouble to make this happen. And, you know, and you're getting up early in the morning and you're sitting 8 hours a day, you know, that's very challenging. And I cannot tell you how much I value your efforts, which are really extraordinary. You know, if this were a temple in Japan or China, people couldn't sit better than you were sitting this morning. So part of this koan is about don't be content with the statue on the altar, but that's corrupting because it says you're off the hook, let others pursue enlightenment, you know. And that's a very false place to be, in my opinion, you know. Nobody can have enlightenment for you. You have to find out for yourself. You have to know, you know, I have to know, you know, at least some people have to know. But another way to think about this koan is that it's also saying that we ourselves can't allow our practice to be something that just exists in the context of practice. In other words, you know, it's possible to do Zen practice in a way that screens it off from everything except Zen practice. And this is very common. This is really common. You know, there was a guy, I years ago I went to study with a man named Shimano Edo Roshi. And I would go to his beautiful temple up on Beecher Lake in the Catskills. And I remember rooming once with this guy who, after the sesshin, he told me all about himself. And he had been a long-term student of Edo Roshi's, but he didn't practice Zen on a daily basis or even a weekly basis. He would just come up to the temple like once a year and just go through like hell, the hell of sesh. It's like I'm only going to run a marathon once. I'm only going to get exercise once a year. I'm going to run a marathon, right? You know, so this guy would come up to the temple and go through this very rigorous 7-day sesshin, you know, and he would be in agony. And then he'd feel like, oh, you know, I've done it. I've done my thing for the year, you know, now back to my ordinary life, right? And And he actually called it. He said, "This is for me. This is karma boot camp. Karma boot camp." So, in my opinion, everybody gets to choose his own life, right? And it could be that he was actually a sage, and I just didn't appreciate it. But my guess would be that, you know, this is a mistake in certain ways, right? I mean, I would say it's a mistake because, you know, he's confining, he's admiring the Buddha on the altar, right? But he's not, the Buddha is not stepping down from the altar into his life. And so this guy was sort of, you could say, restricting all of this to this 1 week, this one hell week, basically, where he would be, his legs would be screaming and so on. And he would be exhausted and so on. And of course, that makes sesshin awful. I myself have been doing sesshin for 40 years, right? So I have times too where my legs really hurt. Like yesterday, about the midday, my left knee was really screaming at me. But, you know, I had a dinner break and I came back and I'm so much better, you know. And I think part of it is my concentration. I had a little mental break and then I came back and all that Zen concentration, you know, transformed everything, you know. But if you don't have that practice, you know, it's very difficult to deal with your physical discomfort. So daily practice helps you, you know, in sesshin. But, you know, the idea of sesshin is not just to come to sesshin and then go back and everything else stays unchanged. The idea is that the Buddha has to come off the seat, the teaching seat, and into your life. And it has to be integrated into your life. And this is where practice comes alive, right? I mean, if we all do this, we all engage in compartmentalization. It's what we do as human beings. So look, you know, if you couldn't compartmentalize, you'd go crazy, right? I mean, so for example, you know, people go to work and their work is a very high pressure environment, right? And they're in emotional distress a lot of the day. And then they come home, and if they're good at compartmentalizing, they can keep sane, right? So you go home, and if you can't free yourself from that high stress environment, you'll go crazy, right? You'll start drinking, or you'll start taking drugs. But some people are very good at like compartmentalizing. So the work is high pressure and very unpleasant, and you come home, you close the door, and suddenly you're in this place that's peaceful and happy, right? And you can enjoy it. And, you know, that's compartmentalizing. And we all have to do that somewhat, or we would be unable to function. But compartmentalizing is also a problem for us, right? Because it's like you might know people who are kind to their family, but very aggressive with everybody else outside their family. You know, there are all these people you will read about who are like wonderful parents. You know, Hitler was supposed to be like a nice guy, you know, actually. And people liked him in his personal circle, right? He was very likable. So, you know, maybe that's compartmentalization in the extreme, but lots of people are able to be one person in one setting and another person in another setting. It's like you're Mr. Rogers at home and you're Genghis Khan out in the world, right? You know. So we all do this to some degree, and we also do it with Zen, right? We also do it with Buddhism. So, you know, we you know, basically make time out to be in a calm state, in a place of centeredness and so on. And we, you know, we can ritualize that and in our daily practice, and we can come to sesshin. But there's this question of, the world beyond sesshin, or the world beyond that hour and a half a day we spend meditating. You know, and what this book is, what Wansong, the editor of this book, is saying is, if you do that, if you just create a Zen world and then you have your regular world and you don't integrate them, you are, you know, you're not really on the path. You know, you're really not on the path. And it creates a problem too in terms of what could be called, I don't know if you ever heard this phrase, but spiritual bypassing. So, you know, if you do Zen or any meditative practice long enough, right, you can get into samadhi pretty easily. So what will happen to you is when you sit down on the cushion, you will get into samadhi fairly reliably. At first, it's very difficult. But eventually, if you do this for a year or two, you know, you can get to samadhi fast. Right, and it's a beautiful, beautiful feeling, right? And you can even get into advanced states of meditation, even more advanced than samadhi. You can get into mushin, you know. And in fact, you know, there are people who have even had daikensho that can be in a kind of luminous, compassionate state, but only in their sitting life, only in their practice. You know, a Buddhist teacher I admire very much named Jack Kornfield studied with two very famous mindfulness teachers in Southeast Asia. And Kornfield said he started with this Thai guy who was a very famous meditation teacher. And he said when he was on the cushion, he was super smart. He could tell you everything about mindfulness, about how we construct our mental world from moment to moment to moment. But he said, you know, when he was off duty, he was like a different guy. He would sit in the kitchen and drink coffee, cups of coffee all day. And he'd read the sports pages. You know, and he said, and he'd make cynical remarks about things, right? And then he said he'd boss people around and he was rather unpleasant. And he said, I once even saw him throw a rock and hit a dog. I saw him throw a rock at a dog. Just get out of here, you know. And it was like, how is this possible that this guy's so advanced in his practice, but he isn't able to, he's so unkind when he's not in his practice. And then he quit that guy wisely. Kornfield went to this other teacher, and the teacher, his name was Achan Cha. And Achan Cha was like a saint, right? And a saint is a person who integrates the two things, right? So off the cushion, he was bringing what's off the cushion into his practice, and he was bringing his practice off the cushion. So this is like perfect, right? This is integrated practice. So if we let the, in other words, Achan Cha was not allowing the Buddha to stay up there. He was bringing the Buddha down here. And, you know, when we do our koan practice, we're doing the same thing, right? We enter samadhi. And samadhi is beautiful and necessary. We get into this beautiful place and, you know, we may, if we're practicing right now, we're all practicing in our homes. We may have an altar, we may have incense and so on. And, you know, if we just get into this serene place, that's a real danger, you know, because we're not dealing with the things that are not so serene, right? I'm sure I'm making sense. It's possible to create a kind of place that's very stable and beautiful, but it's just a little place, right, in our minds. And, you know, as soon as we're out of that situation, we aren't so enlightened anymore. So it's like, I remember once, I have always had to struggle with a temper. I have a temper. In my home when I grew up, people were very aggressive and bullying. And I developed like a temper, like, you know, anger, right? And I remember coming back from the Zen Center in Seattle once, and I was practicing regularly, and I would go and I would feel so serene. And I remember meeting my wife, and we were walking across the street, and our cat was coming to greet us. And this guy came around the corner. We lived on a corner, rather busy corner. Our cat started to cross the street. And this guy almost hit our cat, right? And he didn't slow down. It was just like he almost killed our beloved cat. And I was so mad. I chased him down the street. And you know, Barbara said, you've got to do something about your anger issue, you know. I don't know, would I have beaten him up? I don't know. But I was so upset, right? So that's like no integration, right? No integration. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, we want to be in this luminous, clear place. And, you know, one of the things koans do is to help us to unpack the sources of our samsaric behaviors. Right? Samsara means to go around and around in a circle, repeating the same behavior. So, you know, basically, let's say you have an anger issue, right? And, you know, something happens at work and you snap and you give somebody your piece of your mind, right? And then you let it go, oh, why did I do that? Right? I've got to be less angry. And then, you know, a week later, you're at home and somebody does something and you fly off the handle. Ah, why did I do that? You know, I know I'm an angry person. I've got to count to 10, you know, that kind of thing. But that's not really getting to the issue, right? We don't know what the issue is. We don't know what the roots of our anger really are. We can't know. We can't. Not without help. So you can go to a therapist and you can work with a therapist, and the therapist could help you to see what's at stake and this angry behavior, what's behind this angry behavior. But something like that happens in Zen too. You know, so you're working with a koan, and the koan seems to have nothing to do with trying to chase somebody down the street because he almost hit your cat and beat him up, right? It has to do with, you know, flowers in the spring or something like that, you know, or the last leaves on the tree in the fall. You know, and you start working with this koan and you say, you know, last leaves, last leaves, last leaves, you know, and then all of a sudden you find yourself really angry, really angry. And you think, well, you know, you might come into the Dokusan room and say, I'll say, what's happening with the koan of the last leaves? And you'll say, nothing. I just can't come up with anything. Or you'll say, you know, I'm nothing. When I'm in samadhi, I'm totally empty and blank, right? So when we say that, what we're really doing is we're saying, I like to be in this enlightened state or this samadhi state, and that's where I want to stay. And this other stuff that's coming up, I don't want to look at, or I don't think I should look at it because it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. But it's not irrelevant. You know, if you're sitting with a koan for 6 hours a day, you know, or 8 hours a day, it would be, you know, maybe 6 hours before you come into Dokusan. You're sitting with your koan from, you know, 7 in the morning until 10 at night, or, you know, 9:30 at night. Something's going on, right? And you're saying last leaves, and all of a sudden you have all these memories and all of a sudden you feel these emotions, right? Those are not irrelevant. Those are part of the koan. You might not see the connection, but there's a connection there. You know, so the big mind is trying to say, let's deal with this. Let's deal. We have to work this through. We have to work this through. And so, you know, suddenly you feel this anger, or you remember, you know, maybe you had a father who was always yelling at everybody and pushing you around and making you feel powerless, right? So, you know, that's all forgotten until you start working with your koan. And this stuff comes up and you don't know where it's coming from or why it's coming up. But, you know, it's like the koan is not a question that has an answer. The question is like, the koan is like a spirit guide. Seriously, the koan's like a spirit guide. Right? The spirit guide is taking you on a journey. And it's a journey through your mind, basically. And the spirit guide is revealing things to you, just like a shamanism, right? You know, like a shaman, if you know anything about shaman. So you're sitting there and this stuff is coming up. These usually emotions first, but and then following the emotions, and the emotions we kind of push away, like, I don't want to deal with this, you know, but like, you know, they're there. Usually I often ask people in Dokusan, how do you feel? How do you feel? And, you know, usually people rely, I don't know, I feel sad. You know, I hadn't thought about it. But, and then this stuff comes up, right? They start, well, I keep thinking about my brother. You know, it has nothing to do with the koan. But of course it does. Right? It's the big mind is showing you something. And the big mind keeps showing you something until there's nothing more to show, right? And in this way, you know, koan training takes us off the cushion, off the Buddha's throne, and into our lives, into the world, right? And that's where we begin to get that integration that's so important. And, you know, if it's possible to use Zen practice as a kind of drug, as a drug, where you're just practicing so that you can get to a peaceful place, period, right? Or a place of clarity, period. And that's really not much different from a drug. You know, people take drugs and they get to a good place. You know, they feel good, right? But on the other hand, you know, medicine changes you, right? A drug doesn't change you. Medicine changes you. You know, now, some things that are classified as drugs are really transformative, I know, but just generally speaking, you know, if you get stoned 3 or 4 times a week, it really isn't changing you, right? If, with all due respect, you're just having a time out, a very sort of, you're just having your time out 2 or 3 times a week. You know, but, you know, medicines change you. They restore you to health. So meditation practice can be a drug or it can be a medicine. And, you know, the problem is taking your medicines. You know, it's hard to take your medicine sometimes, you know. And we all have this problem. I have it too. You know, I too compartmentalize, right? I too compartmentalize. You know, I too, you know, so I practice Zen too. I've been doing this for 40 years, but I too am not, you know, just trying to, I discover my compartmentalization and try to break it down, you know. Usually when there's something we, you know, we discover in the process of our practice that there's something we, that makes us unhappy or uncomfortable, right? And that's like, oh, that's such a rich opportunity. So, you know, maybe you live with somebody and the person has many irritating habits and is not a nice person, right? You know. So, you know, the person comes home and they say something right away. You know, you come home and there's dirty dishes in the goddamn sink, right? And it just sets you off. See that? She never does the dishes. Now look. You say, whose fault is that? It's hers. She didn't do the dishes. But actually, your reactiveness is the issue, right? It's not the dirty dishes. You know, you can do the dishes or not do the dishes. But, you know, the Buddha doesn't come home and go, ah, I could kill her, dirty dishes again, see? So the problem there isn't the dirty dishes and isn't the person who's irresponsible and childish and doesn't do the dishes. The problem is your reactiveness. So the you know, it's not a matter of that person not doing the dishes. You're not Buddha-like in that moment because you're compartmentalizing, right? And I was Buddha-like when I was at the Seattle Zen Center, but when somebody almost ran over my cat, I wanted to beat them up. So I had been compartmentalizing naturally. You know, so what Zen practice is all about is gradually uncompartmentalizing, you know, that we have all these compartments, but we start dissolving those and bringing all of this into the enso of our life, which is an awakened life. Right? And it's easy to think others are the problem or the situation is the problem. And I'm not being glib about this because it's so painful, you know. Sometimes in my life, I have been involved in, you know, institutional politics. And I have sometimes been treated unfairly by the institution where I work, you know, because of institutional politics. And when things have happened to me that have been unpleasant, you know, of course, I blame myself. I felt wounded, I felt unhappy, I felt, you know, like I maybe deserved it, maybe didn't. All of this is an opportunity to practice. It is to become awake, more fully awake. You know, and so, you know, when we compartmentalize, you know, it allows us not to address these things. And when things, it can be as simple as somebody not doing the dishes or getting a bad report from your boss or something, you know, the problem really isn't the bad report. The problem isn't the dirty dishes. It's that we are not able to integrate this experience. We're not able to work it through and become clear. Yesterday, I mentioned that the Buddha said, you know, the Buddha had anuttara samyak sambodhi, which means things just happened to the Buddha. Things just happened to the Buddha. They didn't register these powerful emotional responses, right? Things happen to us that aren't karma. When people talk about karma, they are often misinformed. So if you get cancer, that is not karma. That is not karma. If you get hit by a car, that is not karma. If you have a metabolic disorder, that is not karma. That's what the Buddha called causes and conditions. Causes and conditions. So look, Donald Trump became president of the United States, right? That is causes and conditions, not karma. It's his karma, but it was something you couldn't control that happened to you, right? That happened to you. And things that happen to you are not karma. Karma is how we respond to things that happen. So anyway, this is just the most wonderful koan in the world, because it's about how we like the Buddha to be up there on the seat, but we have to bring the Dharma into our everyday lives, which doesn't mean just being peaceful. It means dissolving our barriers, our compartmentalizations. One day, the world-honored one ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, "Clearly observe the Dharma of the King of the Dharma. The Dharma of the King of the Dharma is thus." The world-honored one then got down from the seat. "The unique breeze of reality, do you see? Continuous creation runs her loom and shuttle. It's all Buddha. It's all Buddha all the time, but are we aware of it? Weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring, but nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking." So look, it's all one world. It's not multiple worlds. It's all one world. And it can all be one enlightened world or not. But the compartmentalizations are false and illusory. And we practice to see how that's so.